Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy summer-ish.
Happy summer, indeed. We're calling this the start of the off-season podcast. So a little bit of the usual topics that are going to go on here. We're going to throw some shade at some other schools. Might throw some shade at ourselves. And maybe some publications as well. Yeah, should be eventful.
We're just not going to make any friends.
Nope, that's kind of our MO. Make as few friends as possible. That's how I started blogging about Syracuse, and God damn it, that's how I'm going to stop blogging about Syracuse. We jump into recruiting stuff. I wouldn't say there's like a ton of recruiting news lately. I think it's actually scaring a lot of people how little is going on that front. Yeah, might as well jump into some of the news from the last couple of days, starting with the bad, and then we can end with the good. Sawyer Smith, target from Florida, did not pick Syracuse this week. He actually picked UCF, and kind of as was pointed out by Stephen Bailey over at Syracuse.com, kind of becomes the latest in a long list of recruits at the quarterback position in particular this cycle to not pick SU. Some of them are expected, guys like Lane Haskins, guys like Jake Van Beek, guys like Jarrett Guarantano that went to Tennessee. Those guys we expected to lose out on, maybe not so much on guys like Jamie Newman that went to Wake Forest. Anthony Brown, who went to BC, and now the latest is Sawyer Smith. So Dan, do you think this is kind of symptomatic of some issues with SU? Is this just the luck of the draw? Obviously, these are just variables, and we're still a long way away from final decisions, but does SU kind of have a problem with getting top recruits at the quarterback position right now?
I don't know. I wouldn't go that far. I actually think that quarterback's a place that, at least on paper, Syracuse is done okay with. It's just a matter of getting one that fits the system, and we've had the coaching turnover, which has hurt. But with this year, I think there's a real trend in players not doubling up at the same school as other top quarterbacks. Yesterday, the Elite 11 announced their 37 semifinalists, and 26 were committed to schools. Actually, now 27, one of more committed today. And none of them, there are no school that has two Elite 11 semifinalists. And there are a lot of, like, the Anthony Brown, who I think was the biggest miss for us. I think that was the one who everyone thought we were really close on, went to BC. He went to Wake Forest, which you mentioned, is also in that group. So I think that players are just becoming more savvy about going to the right school, trying to avoid competition. It's probably symptomatic of why we see a lot more transfers now too. So I think, especially the quarterback position, people are trying to line themselves up to start, and they don't seem to be so willing to jump into a situation where there are two or three other guys in the position, which might be okay for SU. The problem is, you need to get a bunch of guys on campus to find one that works, but at the same time, that might allow Syracuse to get a guy that they might not have otherwise had a chance with because other spots are filled up.
And that totally makes sense. And you know what? Again, I mean, obviously the recruiting game has changed a lot. It's going to continue to change. I think these variables are starting to mean a little bit more for the top guys. You know, Bud Elliott posted an article, I think, 3 months ago on SB Nation, where it was something like, I want to say, it was like 80% or something of blue chips that already committed. I mean, he didn't really try to pontificate too much on where those guys would end up ultimately landing. But again, I think, and we had this conversation kind of on Slack the other day, our internal chat room here at Steph. You know, basketball will always be different because of the limited number of slots, because of the one-and-done potential. But football is, at least for the top players, starting to move slightly in that direction, I think, in the last couple of years now.
Yeah, I think there, I mean, there are more 7-on-7 camps. There are more outside people becoming part of the process, which isn't always great. But I think it's definitely becoming a little more like basketball. Obviously, it's never going to be the same because you're dealing with classes of 25, 30 kids versus classes of oftentimes one or two. But it's definitely the process getting started earlier for sure. Like now you have sophomores, freshmen. I mean, there have been middle schoolers identified by the recruiting services, which is very strange. But it is where we are now. So unfortunately, you know, we might not always be fans of things, but you kind of have to go with the times and not fall behind, unless you're like Alabama and just do whatever you want.
Agreed. So I guess wrapping up with Sawyer Smith, and we have a lot of guys to kind of talk about. Do you think Smith stays with UCF, or do you think, I mean, again, I don't want to play crystal ball here, but do you think Smith is likely to stay with UCF, or do you think he ends up getting some additional interest from bigger programs and ends up there instead?
I don't know much about him. He wasn't a guy that was, I knew of him, but there was never a guy that I thought that we were really in on it. Like I said before, Anthony Brown was really the quarterback, and then David Morkit from SMU, really the two that we seem to really have a good shot with. I know Moore, obviously, nothing's final until February, but Moore seems like maybe he'll listen a bit. Brown seems to have locked it down a little bit. But like Haskins and a couple of the other bigger guys were always kind of pipe dreams. And I didn't know too much about the Smith kid, so it's hard for me to tell whether or not he'll stay there. It's always tricky with early commitments to non-power programs, Syracuse included in some respects. One of the kids that we ended up talking that we have heard about a little bit today, Sionte Woolard, who was an Elite 11 kid back in 2013, or the 2013 commit, I guess the Elite 11 was in 2012. He was in the same class as Zach Allen, and he was a USF commit for a long time, and then he flipped pretty late to UCLA, pretty late in the process. So, you know, when you're a program like that, you obviously want to get those kind of kids in your class, but there's only so much you can do, I think, to hold on to them. So it really depends on what kind of outside pressures he gets, and what kind of other, you know, if he blows up or if he really shuts down his recruitment into the night. So it'll be interesting to follow. It seems to me like Syracuse will probably end up going in a different direction, just because we'll probably want to lock up a quarterback or two sooner than later.
Fair, and I guess we'll stay with the quarterback position. We'll get back to Woolard because there's a whole nother conversation there. But some big news, it seems, for a guy who kind of slipped under the radar, obviously well-regarded, but still under the radar in terms of the national buzz, Rex Culpepper from down in Tampa, 3-star guy, doesn't have an offer in hand from SU by everything I've seen, but apparently, and this was just revealed today, I had him on Syracuse.com, He's been having about 2 years worth of conversations with Tim Lester to kind of come up to Syracuse, and he's finally going to visit this coming Tuesday, which is, you know, very exciting and kind of, you know, leads us to, okay, like, is this the guy? And if he is, what happens to some of our other targets, whether it's Joshua Jackson from Michigan, whether it's Brodsky, or whether it's someone like David Moore, who is a well-regarded player, you know, currently committed to SMU. Dan, do you think that if we get Culpepper, that we're necessarily going to kind of cool off on some of the other guys? Or do you think Culpepper could be one of several that we try to bring in for 2016?
It's hard to tell. I think the fact that he might not, that he doesn't have an offer yet, might be indicative of us not wanting to offer too many quarterbacks while we try to recruit some of the other ones. And maybe we've just moved on to him, and that's where all this mutual interest comes. So I'd be surprised if he didn't get an offer. I mean, if you look at his offer list, he's a 3-star player, and we haven't heard too much about him, but he has legitimate, like, 4-star level offers. Just going down the list, Clemson is big on him. Miami, NC State, Ohio State, Mississippi State, Utah, Vatech, Virginia, West Virginia, and Florida have all reportedly offered. Now, you know, we can't always verify these, but generally, when a kid has that list that big, it's not made up. He's also an NFL legacy, so it's not like he's some kid who is coming out of nowhere. Like, he's been, he's in the football world. He's from a really good program down in Tampa, Plant High School. So this is a kid that, if you can beat out those kind of schools, or if those are the kind of schools that offer him a quarterback, I mean, he's a really good player. So it sounds like things are going really well. Hopefully the offer comes in soon. Hopefully he gets up here. I know he just set his visit date. And just lock him up, because, honestly, he has better offers than pretty much everyone else we're involved with, Hastings aside, which was always, kind of a shot in the dark. But it's good to see that we still have an impact in Florida, which I know we've had to rebuild since losing George McDonald last year.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, no secret, I was never a huge McDonald fan. And granted, he's probably going to firebomb my house one day. I think that McDonald's strength down in Florida might have been a little overstated. And I think we're seeing a huge kind of push to get a couple of those guys now. Obviously, Culpepper could be one of them, even if it's not in South Florida. What I find interesting about him is the fact that he doesn't have an offer in hand, according to reports, but still excited to come Tuesday. And according to the article he had with Scout today, it seems that SU is the number one, and he's going to make a pretty quick decision afterward, potentially picking SU. For me, I'm not going to say that the position is now locked up for 2016 with Culpepper. I think you might want to bring in a couple guys, because there are no guarantees. But having someone like Culpepper, who is well-regarded, does have some big offers, for him to pick Syracuse over some of those names, I mean, no, it's not earth-shattering. We saw what happened with Robert Washington. We saw what happened with, to a lesser extent, Jake Picard. But I'm excited to have him kind of offer and get some momentum back. It's not that we've lost momentum, but the perception, obviously, for a little while, was, some things were rolling in. We've obviously offered higher-caliber kids. So I am looking forward to hear Culpepper decide sooner rather than later. As long as Tuesday goes well, I think we should hear from him with an orange tinted decision very soon.
Yeah, I mean, anything can happen, but it's certainly read like we're coming up to visit. We just want to make sure everything is as good as it sounds. And there's no reason for them to say a commitment to come soon if that wasn't actually a possibility. So hopefully they come and the coaches can close the deal on campus. And over the last couple seasons and over the last two staffs, the Syracuse coaches have done a really good job of closing once guys have gotten to campus. It's getting them here, which is the biggest obstacle. So hopefully that remains true once Culpepper comes up and we can just lock up the quarterback position. I'm always in favor of taking as many quarterbacks as you can, but that's not always possible because of what I said before, guys not wanting to go and join classes at two or three. So just get the one that you really want and then worry about that, and don't, do anything to lose or sacrifice that ability. But we do, it would be nice to get someone that well-regarded on campus in a couple of years.
Yep. And I guess closing out our quarterback conversation here, and you kind of alluded to him earlier, Ashante Woollard, UCLA four-star dual-threat quarterback, class 2013, announced this afternoon that he will be transferring from the Bruins program. And anytime there's like a big name announcing transfer, I kind of just do a quick search, see who his offers were, just to get a read on where he might be headed. And again, that's no indication of where he's going to go, but at least you kind of get an initial conversation started about his potential destination. And lo and behold, Woollard did get an offer from Syracuse for the 2013 cycle. Dan, not that we really know anything from Woollard right now in terms of where he might go, but do you think Syracuse has a shot here? And we don't want to jeopardize incoming recruits, but Is this the type of person we might need? Still have 2 years of eligibility remaining after NCAA transfer rules kick in. This is the kind of player we need to maybe at least kickstart some additional interest at the skill positions outside of, you know, Robert Washington.
I think it's a guy that you definitely go after if he's available. It seems weird, like, and we obviously don't know. It's tough for the transfers because there's not as much news going around them because they're a little more guarded a lot of the time. But it seems like the Schaefer staff has been kind of reticent to go after transfers, especially after the Drew Allen debacle. This kid was one of the, I mean, he was probably a top five, top 10 quarterback in his class. Obviously, UCLA has been pretty stacked at the position and have brought in a number of top players there. So it's understandable why he transferred. I'm always a little weary about saying Syracuse can get involved. They did offer him. There was some mutual interest there a couple of years ago, but it wasn't really anything that got too far off the ground. Seems more likely that he ends up going to a school like South Florida, where he originally committed, somewhere back close to the home. But that doesn't, you know, going home doesn't seem to be the operative reason for his transfer. So maybe there's a shot, but it's tough to tell unless, you know, until you actually hear news come out. But it could be anything. It's interesting that, you know, he's a Florida kid, but he was at UCLA. So maybe the being homesick is a part of that. And he wants to go to somewhere closer, or maybe it's all about playing time. And if that's the case, then it would definitely be available after a year. So I would hope that Syracuse would inquire at least, but I don't know. It seems like we don't always do that, even when there is some kind of, at least there was some mutual interest back during the original recruitment.
Right. Yeah, to be honest, I do think that one of those Florida schools seems like the best bet. A long shot might be headed down to Florida A&M, which expressed interest back when he was being recruited. They wanted to play right away. I know I asked Bruin Nation, SB Nation's UCLA blog, on Twitter earlier, you know, is he worth going after? Is he worth, you know, taking a look at? And they seem to think that he showed a lot of progress in spring practice, which, you know, could mean a lot, could mean a little. But the fact that he made strides and really wasn't being guaranteed a starting quarterback job this year, I think all contributed. I don't necessarily think he's headed, you know, home to Florida as a guarantee, but I wouldn't rule it out. You know, I think UCF is getting involved in more and more of these big conversations. I mean, I think that program is now seen as one of the top probably five, you know, group of five programs, one that can get itself into a New Year's Bowl conversation pretty easily. And it's disheartening for a program like the Bulls that you know, sniff the top of the mountain before tumbling very far down. Kind of sucks for them. But, yeah, I think UCF is definitely in that conversation for a lot of these guys from Florida to transfer out. And I would put them in the lead right now, with USF kind of second. I wouldn't necessarily put any stock into FIU. But I think Syracuse can work itself into this. You know, if he sees an opportunity to really – I don't see him being a one to embrace a program savior-type moniker, but I do see him as someone willing to embrace a clear starting role, and that's where I think we can offer up an advantage that a lot of others might not be able to give him.
For sure. And, you know, that he would still be playing in the ACC. He'd have a chance to play in his home state a couple times. So hopefully we give it a shot at least.
No, completely agree there. I think that's what I'm mostly concerned with, is at least let's make a go of it and see if we can get a guy like that. But last kind of piece of news around football personnel, well, player-wise anyway. Along with the Sawyer Smith news that was put up today on the site, we also had Devin Clark, who was committed to Oregon State until he wasn't. this weekend, and now he is planning a trip to visit campus, Syracuse University, obviously, along with Bowling Green and USF. Now, we would hope that we were considered at least in higher regard than both of those programs, but maybe not. You know, it's another Florida kid, so you can assume that somebody like Bobby Acosta is probably involved, given he's taken over some of the Florida recruiting duties since McDonald left. But, you know, I think what Clark, while he's maybe not like the flashiest name or the, you know, biggest star rating, if you want to put any stock into that, what he is a solid safety. And I think what we need in the program, and that's why I think you and I and several others are really high on Marquise Blair for 2015, provided that he qualifies, that we really need help in the secondary and guys, you know, showing, getting interest elsewhere and still coming to Syracuse on the secondary in particular is huge, because it's been such a pain point in recent years. And I think Clark, while you never know what happens at the collegiate level, is someone who could really help create a sea change of talent at those positions.
Some kid from Florida, Oregon State is pretty daunting. I don't know if it's quite as daunting as him up to Syracuse, where there are probably more Florida players. You know, he's probably seen guys who he knows or at least familiar with go up and see it at SU. But like you said, he's a safety, and we really need that. He's also a 6'3" safety, very rangy. Kind of fits the bill, like a Darrell Estridge, maybe not as physical, but we know that we like that size back on the defensive backfield with guys like Estridge and Keon Lynn in the past. So he seems like he'd be a good fit in the system with in Schaefer's defense. And Bullitt's defense, I guess, now. But so we've lost some of these battles to schools like Marshall before, so it's not always a given, but the fact that he's coming up to campus is a good sign. It always is. So if we get him up here and he enjoys himself, I wouldn't be shocked if he ends up committing. I'm always a little concerned about these kids who flip around their commitments a lot. It doesn't always seem to work out in our favor, although there are guys like Grizzly Esteem who, if you guys remember, basically like tweeted at programs directly to like just like offer him and he'd commit, and Syracuse was that program that offered him at the end. Get him committed and take your chance. I'd rather be in the pole position than not. So he seems like he's not an overwhelming prospect, but definitely a solid player who would fit in here well, I think.
Right. And I mean, you know what, at the end of the day, these, like, whether they're overwhelming or not, can be a double-edged sword, because we've seen guys who weren't quote-unquote overwhelming in the recruiting process that ended up being stars for SU. One other guy who actually is even less highly regarded relative to Clark, but at the same time could be just as important. Another safety from Tampa, actually a friend of Rex Culpepper's, Scoop Bradshaw. And Stephen Bailey reported late on Wednesday, looks like he will also be visiting next Tuesday. He's a two-star guy, but he's got offers from a lot of upper-tier MAC schools, some of the lower-tier Big Ten schools in Utah. So definitely getting on people's radars at the very least. And again, defensive back is going to be a pain point. It has been a pain point. So anything we can do to fix that would be perfect, and, you know, create some depth there, since we are sorely, sorely lacking on it. On the current roster and even the roster this fall. So Bradshaw's another name to watch. He's another guy who could be a quick commit. I'd love to see, I mean, again, you never know what happens with these kids. You don't want to see too many flips. Starts to create a perception of, you know, what's going on in chaos. But at the same time, you know, getting 6 to 9 names in the door at least by midsummer, even if they're not, you know, again, signed on a dot. It does create some sense of stability. I mean, some of the bigger programs have 15, 20 guys committed for 2016 already, and they might lose a quarter of those. But when you lose a quarter of 20 guys versus losing a quarter of, you know, 6 to 8 guys, it's definitely a very, very different atmosphere.
For sure. And Bradshaw's not a guy with a huge list yet, but he does play for a good program, obviously the same one as Culpepper. And there was a little tidbit in the Bailey article that if Culpepper commits, the family thinks that his brother will go to the same school, who's a tight end, already a pretty big kid. He's like 6'3", 240 or something. I can't remember exactly how big he was, but something like that. It's always good if you can get a two or a three for one. So I'm not totally opposed to greasing the wheel a little bit if you had to give an offer out to Bradshaw or an early offer out to the brother, if that'll get everyone locked up.
Yep, and you know what? I think that was the design with Washington, too. I mean, obviously, Washington's a big get on his own, but there were even bigger fish to loop in with him. So I think we'll see there, and I think we'll see on Culpepper as well.
That brings us
about the F time.
Washington's not a big deal. It's only a three-star, from according to a couple of sites. No big deal.
Yeah, you know what? Before we get to halftime, I think we need to talk about that. As some might have noticed today, I think a lot of us are a little irate about it on Twitter. Robert Washington was downgraded on ends up 24/7, never had him as a four-star, but was it Rivals that downgraded him to a three-star?
Yeah, that has him at four. Rivals had him at four. ESPN, I believe, has him at four. And 24/7 always had him at three, but their composite rankings with Whale, four, had him at four and still does. I'm not sure if the rival downgrade has impacted that or not. So it's all stupid. He hasn't played a game since last time he was rated. Nothing's changed. He hasn't gotten, you know, unless something crazy that we don't know about has happened, he hasn't gotten slower or less strong. And, you know, he only has the most offers out of any running back in his class. So it's not anything to worry about. There are, as much as people don't want to admit it, there do seem to be some politics that play along with the rating. He's never been a kid who's camped, done all the camps. He's been kind of been recruited real since he was in eighth grade. He was originally committed to Mississippi State as a freshman. So the process is kind of old for him now. So he hasn't really played the game as much as a lot of other recruits do. And that doesn't always do great things for your star rating, but the star rating is also a imaginary thing applied to players. So, not really anything to worry about, but I did enjoy complaining about it on Twitter, because what else is Twitter for? Not for complaining about star rating.
And yeah, I think it's just, it was so incredibly foolish. And while the 4 and 5 star ratings, I think 5 in particular, if it got to 5 star, I think proof has been shown that those players do work out a lot and that they are program changers. You see the success both at the college level and at the pro level. But at the same time, you know, where it starts to get stupid and just kind of turns into minutia is when you deal with these fringe 3-4 or fringe 2-3 type guys. And again, like seeing a guy like Washington, who, God forbid, he commits to a program outside of, you know, the typical power brokers of college football, you know, suddenly he goes from a 4 to a 3, despite not taking a snap in the meantime. It's just, it's silly. It's better not to pay attention to it, but for people that cover it, you kind of can't help but see, you know, kind of the politics and the nonsense that goes on. So it's disappointing, but at the same time, if Washington shows up, kills it, where's 44, the whole deal. I doubt anyone's going to mind what his star rating was.
Yeah, and the ratings are, there is some validity to them, I think, on a macro level. We've had this time, I think we've discussed this before. Like, if you have a program and you're bringing in 15 kids every year that are considered to be 4-star players, I think there's a better chance of you landing a double kid who end up being whatever the proverbial 4-star player is than if you're just bringing in a bunch of 2s and 3s. But on a single player level, I mean, it's kind of slicing hairs a little bit. So nothing to worked up about it, I don't think, for this one guy, especially one who has gotten the attention and offers from like every major program, and also Kentucky now. You got a Kentucky offer last week, so that was fun.
Good for you guys, Wildcats.
You're really on top of your recruiting.
All right. So on that note, now that we've trolled some people, yeah, a little halftime. So, Dan, what have you been drinking?
Just give me 1 second to get this open. Every week we play the
Go
game of having untapped.
My key check mark, Dan. Dan and I will be drinking together next week, so we'll actually have some things in common, beverage-wise, probably, or at least beverage location.
For sure. We'll get to compare notes a bit. My app is being really
live.
Yes. I don't know. I'm trying to, off the top of my head, I can't remember. I did have two roads there. Road Jam, which is a raspberry sour, which is very good. It's obviously, you know, it's not like a raspberry wheat or one of those, you know, that you probably have from UFO or even like the Blue Moon kind. It's very much a sour with solid fruit flavor, but, you know, really nice drinkable, but not like overly sweet or you know, it doesn't taste like a soda. So that was good. I think of a couple of the other ones I had recently. I'm really struggling with this app.
No, it's really fine. I pulled up your untapped. Seems like you had some stuff from Brooklyn Brew lately. And both of them, I think you had a Shaq Phoenix and a Shaq Meister. Both of them seem like.
Oh, yeah. We were hanging out in Madison Square Park, where the Shake Shack is. They have their own beers brewed by Brooklyn, which is pretty cool. The regular, I think the Shackmeister Ale is like their general one. It's, you know, a solid, you know, they're both pretty solid beers. The summer I wasn't quite as high on, but you know, for a burger chain, it's not a bad effort. Although it is brewed by Brooklyn, which does have some really exceptional ones.
Too true. Before we move on to mine, I know my brother doesn't live too far from Two Roads now, so we'll be checking that out while I'm in town next week.
Yeah, it's a very good one. So I'm hoping to hear what you have to say about those guys.
Of course. All right. As is typical, when we take a week off, as we did last week, I have a long list of shit to discuss. So, some good ones that I've had lately. We had Mount Remarkable from Modern Times. I've discussed Modern Times numerous occasions here on the blog, on the podcast. It's a really good kind of session pale lager. Again, Modern Times makes some great stuff. I highly recommend that. Had a Malefactor, kind of a Flanders Red from Upland. Got to grab that on the way out of Indiana when I was at the Final Four. I was really, really glad. Sat on that one for a little bit. Made a Rangers win that night. And this was over a week ago now. More enjoyable, though, as I won't talk about. The Rangers did not do too well when it comes to the entire series. No comment again. Some other things that I got to enjoy. Stopped down at the brewery, one of my favorites. As most will attest to, got to enjoy. So happens it's Tuesday. It's a really nice bourbon barrel aged beer from them. I've had some different variations. Never got to try the original for some reason, as was the Cuvée, the bourbon barrel aged anniversary beer that that they put out. So while I didn't want to spend 25-ish on a bottle, I was willing to spend the like $3 or so for a taster, and it was well worth it. Got to check out the Points Unknown IPA from Stone. It's a collaboration beer that they put out recently. It was kind of intended to be a Belgian at first. Ended up kind of turning into a really nice Belgian IPA. That was a really, really enjoyable one in my book. And beyond that, also got to stop at Smog City. They had a bunch of different things on tap, which was great. Including the Kumquat Saison, which I enjoyed so much on draft that I grabbed a bottle of. So I'm looking forward to that bottle. But the right amount of kumquat in there, but still kind of keeps all the characteristics of a typical Saison. Definitely recommend it for those out here in LA, along with Cuddlebug. They're very mild sour, kind of peaches and apricots, I believe. Another really good option. And then I'm currently enjoying the I Love It IPA from Noble Ale Works. Had it on tap a while back. Noble got really, really rave reviews on it, so they decided to bottle it. Luckily, my local Whole Foods had it today, so got to enjoy that. That's everything with beer. Again, sorry for the lack of brevity.
It's okay. We know that's why everyone's here.
That's exact. To be honest, we've actually gotten some feedback on Twitter. That's why half of you are here, or at least a quarter of you. So yeah, moving on. I think we had plenty to say about recruiting in the first half here. One thing I wanted to bring up, Dan, I don't know if you were a big part of this conversation on Slack. Athlon kind of talked about their strength of schedule, rankings for the ACC, and one of the main points that I took away from it was that it's impossible to beat NC State in Raleigh based on what they had to say. And I was confused by that a little bit, especially because we beat them in Raleigh a couple years ago. And I went back and looked at the last three seasons, and the Wolfpack are 12-9 at home since 2012. And I was just kind of confused as to how that trip is impossible for Syracuse or anyone else. When a team is barely over 500 on their home field, I was kind of curious what you felt there.
I'm going to boil this down to when discussing the ACC, when you don't actually follow the ACC, everything boils down to just talking about the Noles. And the Noles famously lost in Raleigh at a night game a couple of years ago. And there was that dude that was swinging his shirt and sending it to the pole, and it was real funny. And then Tom O'Brien died.
Greatest celebration ever.
It was fantastic. And then the Noles went to Raleigh last year and almost lost, but didn't, because they were the 2014 Florida State Seminoles, and they didn't lose until they did. So, yeah, basically I feel like people probably thought of those two games. They're like, wow, this team can upset you, or they'll at least come pretty close. It's really hard to win there when really they're pretty mediocre.
Yeah, I understand that, and I like some of the guys over at Athlon. I understand that there's a tough job to evaluate all 128 teams and really get to know them, kind of deep down. But at the same time, sweeping generalizations like NC State is tough at home. At one point, maybe that was true. In the last 3 years, it has not been true. Last June in particular, the team had a losing record at home. But they also said that Syracuse had a middle of the road kind of tough schedule in general, and kind of regarded trips to Charlottesville and Tampa as difficult for us. I know not a lot of people are buying into Syracuse this year, and I'm not really willing to buy in myself, past six wins as an absolute max, but, Dan, if you had to isolate the tough games, where would that list kind of start and end? Because I don't think it's really as lengthy of a list as a lot of people are suggesting right now.
For Syracuse? Are we talking about the Syracuse schedule?
Yep, just for the Syracuse schedule.
Obviously, Florida State. They're going to be a different look team, but we're going to assume Everett Dolson wins that job, and while Everett Dolson isn't always great, he wasn't in Syracuse. So I don't expect SU to win that one down in Tallahassee. Obviously, LSU at the Dome. LSU, not a great offense last year, but they bring back Leonard Fournette. They bring back Travon Dural. I assume a little bit more or more effective quarterback play, because they bring back both the guys who played there last year who have gotten a year older, and Brandon Harris's family's making a lot of noise about, you know, thinking he should have played more last year, and I'm sure Anthony Jennings doesn't want to give up his position. So I assume LSU is going to be a tough one there, LSU. And then Clemson, who I don't think it's crazy to think they might win the ACC next year. They probably don't have a top-to-bottom roster quite as good as Florida State, but if Deshaun Watson stays healthy, I think there's a very good chance he is in the Heisman conversation. So, yeah, those are all three, I think, bona fide, really hard games. I can't imagine situations where they're not. And then you have the normal group of Louisville who might be a little bit down next year, but should still be pretty tough, and Pitt, who we can't seem to get, you know, an edge on, and BC, who, you know, plays up to their potential most of the time, and obviously ran us last year, and NC State, who's, you know, decent, if not unbeatable at home, where we play the next year. So it's not a – I think it's a pretty – when you have three games like LSU, Clemson, and Florida State, I think that outside of the SEC, that's pretty much as you can ask for from a program.
Right. And honestly, like, that's what I didn't understand in their evaluation. It seemed that every game was tough for us. It seemed like we were the bottom of the barrel. It seemed like we'd already dropped down to the Greg Robinson level depths. And I just couldn't understand it, especially when you look at the schedule. I think a lot of us were sitting here thinking, this is one of the easiest schedules we've had in a while. I mean, yes, some of the lesser teams are on the road. I think a USF in Virginia, I think those two games in a row. Something could trip us up, admittedly, but I wouldn't call those games tough by any means. If we learned anything about either of those programs lately, it's that they don't know what the hell's going on even more than we don't. We've been to bowls more recently than both of them. And, I mean, Pitt's at home. And, you know, you never know what to expect with Pitt. BC is at home under Addazio. BC is not exactly like a predictable entity. CMU is probably going to take a step back, and we beat them pretty handily last year. I mean, this – I'm not saying Syracuse is winning the ACC by any means, but to consider this a tough schedule, I think this is kind of a gift. In many ways, we weren't beating Florida State no matter where we face them, so – so the fact that we're in Tallahassee doesn't really bother me much. LSU, same deal. Sucks to lose a home game, but what are you going to do? We aren't going to beat them on the road either. Louisville, I don't think it's the drop in the bucket that everybody else does, but I do think we lose that game. And then Clemson, same deal. Like, whether it was the Carrier Dome or Death Valley, I don't think we're winning that game this year. And the fact that we played as close to the best as we did last year, I think was impressive enough. And we'll have plenty of time to really thoroughly preview Syracuse and go down the full schedule later in the summer. But I don't know. To me, I keep seeing a lot of articles just writing us off, and I guess I'm almost getting excited about that fact that there were zero expectations this year, and that could provide us with a hell of a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, it is interesting because, 2 years ago, when it came to like the coin flip games between with like NC State and Maryland and Pitt and those type of teams, I guess Virginia would probably be fit in there this year. Syracuse did pretty well to win a bunch of them, and it wasn't always pretty, but they seemed to know how to get the most out of them. And then against the really hard teams, they just got walloped. And last year, obviously, things didn't go well. They went to Syracuse on 3-9, but they hung in with the really good teams pretty deeply. Clemson, if Syracuse had a quarterback who wasn't making his, I believe that was A.J. Long's first actual start, and say that we had a veteran quarterback in there and not a revolving door of injuries on the offensive line, that's really a game Syracuse sort of won. And at Florida State, a pretty promising performance. Louisville was a disaster, but it wasn't like we didn't get like totally run out of the building. It was just, you know, a series of calamities. But Syracuse actually, I think, performed better last year against the harder opponents, but couldn't get over the hump in the coin flip games and ran into steam because of injuries. So I think there's maybe an optimistic read of the last 2 years where if we can keep injuries manageable like they were in 2013 and play the the daunting game's tougher, like we did in 2014, maybe there's a light at the end of the tunnel here where we can kind of not have a disastrous injury season last year and maybe surprise some guys again. I think it does set up well where LSU is really the only early game that you can probably cross off. You have URI, Wake, Central Michigan, and USF, which should all be wins by all accounts. Virginia, I hope we can at least say there's a better than 50-50 chance we win that game, considering Virginia's been pretty bad for half a decade now and just lost a quarterback to Georgia, which is a really weird story that doesn't make much sense to me. And then you get into the Pitt, Florida State, at Louisville, but, you know, there should be a decent chance of Syracuse, even if they're not a great team, opening up 5-1. And then you just got to, I mean, we've been here before, but then you just got to get one at the end. And it's not like Syracuse hasn't beaten some of these teams before. We've beaten Louisville, Pitt, all recently. It's hard to tell because this team is so hard to read because so many pieces were gone last year, and last year was such a disaster in many respects. But if they stay healthy and some of the players that we thought would break out last year end up doing so this season, there's an optimistic read to the schedule. And the beginning of it definitely does help because you always want to get a jump on that bowl eligibility.
No, absolutely. And I think it's weird that to me, no matter who it is, it seems like everyone's kind of railing to read between the lines that, again, no, this is not going to be a 9-win team, but let's discuss the fact that this team played some pretty good opponents pretty close. It's just odd to me that a lot of commentators and a lot of observers are willing to read between the lines on other teams, and they're not willing to for a few, and I don't know if that's a result of a dislike toward Schaefer because of one comment about snow in Atlanta, or whether it's a dislike for the fan base based on what, I'm not sure, or whether it's based on NCAA violations that when it comes to college football, no one's really care about because all it did was just remove terrifying losses that I wanted scrubbed out of my memory anyway. It just seems that we've reached this point where Syracuse cannot win, no matter what it does. There's just this cloud hanging over the Orange program in terms of college football commentators and bloggers, et cetera. I just don't see the schedule as insurmountable. And I think it's actually going to be entertaining. I mean, if we don't start 5-1, I think it's feasible. If we start 4-2 instead, there's still wins out there. I mean, I threw this out there a couple months ago, and I know you, me, and Sean in particular all talked about it. SU's going to lose 4 games, win 4 games just about every year. And what defines the season is that middle, meat of the schedule there. And that's NC State, that's BC, that's Pitt, and usually Louisville. Maybe Louisville starts towing into that sure loss category and then our cap 7-5. But for right now, I think the season, you look at last year, you know, if you lose all those swing games, finish 3-9, it's god awful. But 2 years ago, you win the majority of the swing games, good things happen. Suddenly you're a bowl team. And I think if we want to view this realistically, I think we have to start building on that concept first before we can start pulling upsets in the ACC versus what we did in the Big East.
Yeah, it's a really good way to break it down. And it generally shapes out that way. Maybe in some other years, Louisville isn't quite as good and there isn't an LSU-type game on the schedule, but for what the conference is now, Clemson and FSU are always going to be there. Louisville seems to be moving along at a pretty decent level. They're always going to be there, but there are always programs that are at least comparable. And we've been hanging around with Pitt for years now, and they've had a chance to pull away from us a number of times and just haven't done it. So I'm pretty sure Pitt's always going to be doing Pitt things, unless Narduzzi is a miracle worker, and I do think he'll be a pretty good coach. But it is funny because, you know, it's not like people 2 years ago were predicting Syracuse to go to a bowl game in Schaefer's first year. They were largely predicting Syracuse to probably be a 4 or 5 win. And even after he did that, it's not like a lot of people were predicting Syracuse to go to a bowl game last year. Obviously, the fans were, we were all pretty excited heading into last year. But it's not like the national media was expecting Syracuse to break out and be a 6 or 7 win team every year. I think the most optimistic views were like 6 wins, but there's a good chance it's 5 or 4. And that ended up being closer to the truth, but probably not because of just the raw talent on the team, because of some bad coaching at times, bad injuries, a lot. So I have trouble buying into the viewpoint of most of the people outside of the fan base and the people that cover the program on a day-to-day basis when it comes to judging Syracuse, because generally they have their preconceived notions, just like they do about 7-5 every year, no matter what, NC State and others that we weigh in on. And they don't do much to adjust their opinions. And it's happened to have worked out pretty well for them through the G-Rob era and through at least most of the Marone Schaefer era, because if you miss on one bowl season, you can just double down and say they won't go the next year, and that's held true pretty well. But, you know, hopefully eventually we start to turn the tide here and go to multiple bowls and link, you know, decent seasons together. And it's not to say Syracuse is even 5 years away from thinking about competing for the ACC, but nothing would really shock me this year. And I think last year's a hard thing to totally judge the upcoming season on, just because so many weird things that you can't always account for did happen. Like, teams don't, like, no one said Maryland, and I know there was that article that was on the site this week. No one said Maryland was like a dead program when they had to play their fourth string quarterback. People said, oh, they're playing a linebacker quarterback, that's terrible. But Syracuse went through pretty much the same thing this year, and it's an indictment of the program as a whole, which I don't think is totally fair.
Agreed. Yeah, I know we're kind of winding down here, but Dan, what is the hot button issue that you think Syracuse fans should be concerned with this summer? Is it the AD search? Is it decisions on the Carrier Dome? Is it, you know, physically seeing orange uniforms? Is it resolving the 44 controversy? What is your big kind of issue that SU fans should probably be paying the most attention to this summer?
I think the obvious one is the AD search, which is also the one that we have the least information on, because it's not like a coach where you kind of, you could, we did, I think, a pretty good job of penciling some candidates, but you have no idea if they're actually going to be the ones that are discussed or talked to. Where coaches, like, there are way more things that leak out into the media. You can kind of devise who has connections to whom, and, you know, people sniffed out, obviously Schaefer was an easy one, but people sniffed out Marone. It didn't take that long for him to emerge as a candidate when he was hired. So I think the AD is really the ground level thing that needs to be settled. And then hopefully you can get people on message when it comes to things like 44, and you can make, I mean, the dome, I mean, we all kind of know it's going to be renovated. We can all kind of accept it's not going to be a new stadium. I know they haven't, like, totally announced that, but if you read the writing on the wall, that seems to be the most obvious, the most logical thing. But once you get an AD and you can make these announcements, you can settle down or settle the 44 issue once he's up to date on that whole tradition. You get the people in place. There's a little more clarity on Schaefer's future, on the future of some of the other coaching spots. Although, I mean, I know we had softball open up today, but most of the big ones are all pretty much settled. Although, I mean, Boeheim's a whole another thing, but I think you just need to get a good AD in there. Someone who understands what is special about the Syracuse athletic department and what draws people to it and how it connects to the community, the Syracuse community, as well as the greater alumni and outer fan community. And I just think that hopefully we get someone who's competent and who has a good idea about how to make this a really great athletic department again. And then we can start, you know, hammering down the smaller things, like, you know, a final solution for the dome or and 44. I don't want to call it a smaller thing, but I think you need leadership to really nail down exactly how you want to utilize that. And without an athletic director in place, I think that's a real big issue for the whole image of how the school has operated over the last, you know, last couple months, but even, you know, going farther back, because we know that communication and clarity weren't the hallmarks of the Dr. Gross regime.
Too true. And on that note, I think we're good. I know I've had plenty to say about the AD search and everything else. I've thrown myself out of the joke candidate several times. Not exactly sure of the joke anymore based on kind of the things we need and the things that we've seen numerous times over. But, you know, these are weird times for Syracuse fans. These are scary for some Syracuse fans. But, you know, I'm willing to embrace kind of some of the madness here. I think that it presents a huge opportunity for us to really remake what we are as fans, as alums, as just a university community overall. I'm really looking forward to kind of what's next. Obviously, if things don't go well, since the AD search and everything else, then that looking forward to it vibe turns into something much less positive. But until then, I think I'm going to choose to be an optimist, contrary to what probably most people who read me would think.
Yeah, and there's a real reason not to, because even as an AD, we're not going to see the immediate results on the field. And it took us a while to really shake out the positives and negatives, and there were both. As much as, you know, we've been pretty harsh on Dr. Gross, it's pretty natural to be harsh when someone's being fired or what have you. But, you know, he did do some good things. But I think it takes a little while to really see how things are working and how the mechanisms are functioning. So hopefully we get someone in place soonish, and then I think it'll be a lot of fun to kind of break down what they've done in the past, and we'll really get to take a deep dive into a really important position that we haven't been able to do. I'm not sure if Sean lost the blog before Dr. Gross was in place. I don't think he had.
This is the first AD change in the Magician era.
Yeah, I think it's probably pretty close, but no, it'll be fun. Hopefully it's someone that we get to learn a decent amount about, and hopefully it's someone that should inspire confidence, because we definitely do need that.
Could not agree more. And on that note, I think we're good. Dan, as always, thanks for joining us here. Obviously looking forward to grabbing a couple of drinks.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. We'll be able to report back next time we do this, and hopefully we won't have decided to drive up to Syracuse and burn down Manly.
Next week you'll have Troy Noon's an absolute East Coast only podcast as I'll be on Eastern time. So we'll actually be in the same time zone for the first time in quite a while. This is just kind of how we do things around here. It'll be nice to not have to deal with different time zones and late nights and everything else. But on that, you've been listening to Troy Noon. This is an absolute podcast. I'm John. That was Dan. Please be sure to rate, review, star, whatever there is in place for iTunes, for Blog Talk. I greatly appreciate it. And talk to you next week.